Okay, so it's recording now, I guess. Wonderful.
Yes, thank you. Sorry about that.
No, it's fine. All right, I'm sorry for that. Okay. Wait, where's now my... Wait a second. Okay, can you see my screen now?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay, back to where I was. All right. Okay, so split offs. So we know that the particle, that reconstruction for charged particles has some asymmetry. And we know that when we reconstruct photons, we see some fake photons. Okay, we have to keep this in mind. So next, summary. Imagine now we performed the measurement, we reconstructed everything. We have not a perfect detector, but we would like to now reconstruct eta decaying to 3 pions. Okay. In order to do that, I guess many of you are already experienced data analyzer, so you know what I'm talking about. But what we need for reconstructing these events are selection criteria cuts, right? And in order to evaluate what these cuts actually are doing, we did monitoring plots. So in the following slides, I will present a very small analysis walkthrough. Just to give an idea what I'm talking about. And this is an advice I always give to anyone. It doesn't matter how you perform your analysis, whether you do a 10-dimensional super special hyperparameter cut or a single energy cut. Monitor every single step, seriously. You will be thankful, seriously. There are many things to look at. For instance, in our case, we look at, for instance, energies, momentum angles, right before and after the cut. Let's say you have your data calibrated, and you want to check whether you want to select events with a certain energy. Then, of course, you would like to look at the energy distribution you cut on before and after that cut, right? In this case, it's a useful variable, but the drift time hits from your detector doesn't help you in this analysis, right? So that's what I mean. You have to define useful plots. What is always helpful, and it's your best friend in the entire analysis, always and every time, it's energy momentum conservation. This is the ultimate tool, I'd say, and it's a very important aspect in regards with this lecture. And an energy momentum conversation. We will talk about this many, many times. Okay, so let's say we have a reaction, two particles, particle one and particle two, like for instance, the two protons, and then you have n particles in a final state, right? Number 3, 4, 5, 6, or how many? And each particle is defined by a four momentum vector called Lorentz vector, right? With the components x, y, z, or theta, momentum theta phi. We wanted, and the energy. And energy momentum conversation, very basic, is that the incoming four momenta, so for instance, beam plus target, is equal to the outcoming momentum. So now you have your incoming particles, the two proton target and the proton beam, and you have the outcoming particles, in this case, two charged pions and two photons, right? So if you combine, balance out the momentum. The incoming momentum with the outcoming one, then it should always be equal, right? This is energy momentum conservation. If you use the definitions from previous slides, you can, for instance, formulate the overall missing mass, right? So you take the difference between incoming outcoming momentum and then calculate the mass of it. And this should ideally be at zero, right? Because if everything's balanced out, should have a zero, so no missing particles, basically. So here, for instance, you see a plot of the missing mass squared of two protons, the outgoing protons, two pions, and two photons, minus the beam and target, of course. And you see this thing kind of, spikes at zero, but you also see some very non-zero contributions. This has many reasons. One, for instance, is you have not a perfect detector, so you have resolution effects. So you don't have a delta distribution at zero, but you have something smeared out. Also, as I said before, we have particle misidentification, meaning that sometimes a pion is identified as a proton, or a proton is identified as a pion. So these events show likely show up here, right? For instance, if you misidentify this pi plus with a proton, and you do the balance, then you subtract on the much more than you actually have, right? You have incoming beam and target, and then actually you expect to have proton, proton, pi plus, pi minus, gamma, gamma, but one particle is assumed to be a proton, so you assume the wrong mass, so the right hand side is unbalanced, so we have negative values. This is what you actually see here. So there are many reasons why this is not zero, but this is one very useful plot to look at all the time, and we will use this a few times during this lecture. All right. Another very nice tool, I think, is the missing energy versus missing momentum. Essentially, it's the same what I showed before, but unfolded into a 2D plot instead of a 1D plot. So like before, you look at the missing momenta, so you balance out incoming versus outgoing particles, and calculate the missing momentum, which is between zero and any positive value, and you calculate the corresponding missing energy, which is just the energy of the missing momentum vector. And in the bottom plots, you see those plots for the selection, proton, proton, going to proton, proton, plus or minus two photons. And you see this V-like structure. I will talk about it in a second. And the right-hand side, you see the same plots for proton, proton, going to proton, proton, plus or minus. When you see this plot, you might ask yourself, but wait, how this is possible? This guy doesn't have any photons or pions, pi zero. It doesn't have this. They are not produced. But as we learned a few slides before, the detector is set up such that these fake photons might occur, right? So, and this is how this guy actually ends up in this plot. So you have proton, proton, going to proton, proton, two pions, and then plus two fake photons. And this is what you see here. Ideally, what you would expect is that everything is at zero, right? Again, in an ideal, perfect world, when you just would observe the reaction you're interested in our case, two protons and three pions, you would expect this thing to be at zero. Everything be at zero, zero, right? This is the ideal case. But of course, again, you don't have a perfect experiment. So you have resolution effects, you have particle misidentification, whatnot. The semi-ideal case is when the missing momentum and the missing energy are kind of proportional to each other. So these are these diagonal lines, right? This just means that, okay, you have you measured the momenta and they are not measured with high accuracy, but the uncertainty, the momentum and the missing energy kind of are equal, so to say. So you still have the reaction you're looking at, but it's kind of smeared out along these diagonal lines. So everything that follows these diagonal lines is supposed to similar to your background. A signal, sorry. Then, of course, anything else that kind of obviously deviates from these diagonal lines, for instance, stuff shown here, is either incorrect mass assignment, so let's say wrong particle identification. Again, in our case, we switch protons and pions, so those guys end up here. Plus, we have those fake photons, which have very low energy. Or background events that do not match the reaction hypothesis, right? So anything in this part is, as I said, either misidentification or just a wrong reaction you're looking at. Just a word of warning. Everything following these diagonal lines does not mean that it's your background, right? Because if you look on the right-hand side for the proton going to the two pion final state plus fake photons, we also see this V-like shape. So again, just observing these diagonal lines doesn't guarantee that you just have your signal. It's just a guidance, so to say. But when you compare these two plots, you see that the left diagonal is much more pronounced in this direction, And this is due to the case, as I said before, the two photons are low energetic. So if you do the whole momentum energy balance, you see that the two photons cannot are low energetic. So you have basically, you require to have pi plus pi minus and two photons in the final state, but you have pi plus pi minus and two very low energetic photons. So you, again, you have an energy imbalance, and this is what you see here. This is why the left arm is much more pronounced. Okay. So that said, we go to the next set of monitoring spectra, which are also very important, are the missing mass versus invariant mass. Those are helpful if you, for instance, look at intermediate resonance or intermediate particle. For instance, in our case, it would be the eta, right? The missing mass we will talk about today is defined by the incoming proton beam plus target minus the two outgoing protons, right? That's the missing mass, which is shown in this plot on the y-axis. And on the x-axis, you have the invariant mass. So these are the decay products, if you want, right? The pi plus, the pi minus, and the two photons. And again, in an ideal world, we would just observe one reaction of a certain type. And with perfect detector resolution, you would observe that, or you would see that the missing mass of the two protons is equal to the invariant mass of the final state particles, right? But of course,
Daniel,
yeah.
Question. Yeah. So in your invariant mass, is that a typo, or the photon momenta is the same for both?
Thank you. Yeah, that's a typo. It's okay. Gamma 1, gamma 2. Yeah, sorry for that. I will correct it.
Thank you.
Where was I? Yeah. So we see now here this plot for the reconstructed momenta for the reaction proton-proton going to proton-proton, plus or minus, pi zero to decay into photons. Mm-hmm. And you see now this reaction doesn't have any intermediate state, so there's no eta or phi or whatever produced, right? It's just phase space, so you have just a uniform blob, so to say. Of course, ideally, it would be on a diagonal, which it is not. And bottom, in the bottom row, you see the projections, right? So this is the missing mass of the two protons and the two photon four particle invariant mass, right? If you now, for instance, look at the case for the eta, you see, if you look at this plot, you see here at the eta mass, which is 448 MeV, you see this gigantic blob, right? So this is how your signal looks like. So these are the events where energy momentum conservation is fulfilled, and within the resolution of the detector, everything is balances out. This is what you see here. Again, bottom row, you have the projection of the missing mass of the two protons and the invariant mass of the four particles. Again, in an ideal world with a perfect detector, these two distributions should look exactly the same, right? But again, what falls in here is the resolution for the two protons, which are different to the ones for the pions. We have a plus pion and a minus pion. And remember, the detection efficiency is different for the for different charges. Plus, we have fake photons produced. So all this falls into these plots, and that's why they look so different. If you, for instance, look now at the proton-proton two pion case plus the two fake photons, you see a diagonal-like structure, but still, we are looking at the wrong reaction hypothesis, and we have resolution effects. So all these plots I showed now are, more or less the most common ones people are looking at when they do data analysis in physics. Depending on the experiment, you might want to look at other things. For instance, in Glueck, people also often look at the production vertex or whatnot, or beam energy versus, tegger energy or so, I don't know. But for our analysis here, we just need the plots I shown so far. All right.
So Daniel, quick question.
Yeah.
In the last slide, so when it's when the missing mass and invariant mass plot is kind of like smeared out like that, is that just, that's less conservation of energy, or less conservation, I mean? Because you said the other one was much tighter, right? So that was kind of a nice case.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So what goes into these plots is, again, detector resolution, but also here we have two photons, and that are actually not real photons. So we add some kind of noise, yeah, to the distribution. So this is what you basically see here, and plus the resolution of the detector. Yes, and of course, what should I say? The reaction itself, right? So 2π in production is not a sharp peak, right? It's like a smooth distribution. If you look at the true values or the generated values, it has already resolution in nature, so to say. But then you reconstruct the whole thing in the detector, and everything gets blurred up, and then you add, for instance, misidentification and wrong particles to it, and then, so this is what you basically see here. Yeah, it's a folding in of different resolutions, so to say, if that helps.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. So what we'll do next. Yes, we will perform a very, very simple analysis. People might disagree on the way I do it, but it's a very simple one, and I just want to give you an idea what is going on. Okay, so first thing, we start at zero, right? No cuts. We have our data, and we assume everything is calibrated, and we have everything somewhere on tape and on file, and we can analyze it. And first, please pay some attention to the bottom row again. Again, we start off with the missing momentum versus missing energy. We will not cut on this distribution. We will just use it to monitor and see what happens. And again, as you learned before, we will now look at the missing mass of the two protons versus the missing mass of the final particle states. This is now the data that contains all reactions I have discussed before. So the two proton case, the three proton case, and the eta decaying to three protons. Okay. And yeah, so this is how we start. And again, as I said, all cuts I will now show are first guess cuts and are only for demonstration, right? You might now say, oh, this is stupid, this makes no sense. I would make it tighter or broader, or would use an entire different variable. That's fine. Again, it's just for demonstration. Okay, so as I said before, we know that the 2π production is the most dominant background. And we know that this guy produces a lot of fake photons. And this is what you actually see here in the 2-photon invariant mass. Yeah? So we take the four momentum of photon 1 plus photon 2, and ideally we would expect a pi 0, right? And this is the nice peak here, you see the bump you see here. But you have this gigantic tail here at low invariant masses, and this is coming from the 2π guy, right? Again, it's the abundant channel, so you have lots of just 2π flying around, and then they're hitting your detector and producing these low energetic photons. And those end up here because if you add up to low energetic photons with close opening angles to the incoming particle, you have this gigantic peak. So the first thing to do is just say, okay, cut this guy away, right? And you see now the effect if you include this cut. If you look on the bottom plots, you see that everything now gets more defined. So all those weird direct 2π guys are suppressed now, and the V structure in this thing becomes much more clear, okay? So yeah, you request that the 2-photon invariant mass is close to pi 0. This is what this cut is actually doing. And you suppress all the direct 2π guys. Fine. It's a fair thing to do. The next step, we're going to know. Yeah?
When you select that cut, how do you know where to apply those limits? Like how do I know if I want, why is not like, let's say, 0.1? Instead of like 0.7.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Okay. That's a good question. First of all, so what you would usually do is, so first of all, you know that the 2 photons should add up in pi 0. So that's here. Of course, you don't have perfect resolution, so you have a Gaussian-like shape. So everything here is like a Gaussian distribution. And you would do a Gaussian fit, determine the sigma, and then form a 3-sigma window. And you're right. Actually, this 3-sigma window will tell you, hey, cut at 0.1 and 0. whatever. But I said, okay, I don't want to do this. I want to have a soft cut, because when you don't know what to expect, or when when the outcome of your analysis is not clear, you should start with somewhat loose cuts and then vary them when you do the analysis. Okay, so to answer your question, it's basically a 3-sigma cut plus some safety margin But yeah, you're right. Some people don't care about safety margin. They would just do a hard cut on, I don't know, 0.1 and 0.15. That's fine as well. It's a matter of taste, in fact.
You think?
Yeah. Okay, so next step, what we do is also a very common cut is a cut on the missing mass, the one I introduced before, right? You remember this thing that should be around zero? And again, the cut has just chosen arbitrarily. I just said, yeah, minus 0.02 plus 0.02. You can do it closer or wider or whatever you like. I just chose this, I don't know, because it's a Monday. I don't know. But I just want to give you an idea what this cut does, right? Because now you force everything to fulfill energy momentum conservation. Yeah. So you narrow the missing momenta down to zero. And this is what this cut does, right? So if you look at the bottom left plot, yeah, before that cut, yeah, you have some stuff here, but you have this dominating V structure. Now you enforce energy momentum conservation. Bam, and then you see strict V shape. And you also see here now in the missing mass versus invariant mass plot, you see now that we, in fact, now have narrowed everything down to the eta mass, right? This blob here, these are our etas, sticking to 3 pions. That's wonderful. So we could, so up to now we have done a kind of a good job, right? Okay, again, someone else might have done this analysis or cuts different, but again, it's just for demonstration, all right? And just to give you a feeling how one could approach these things. All right. So as a recap or summary, so we successfully selected everything with 2 pions in the final state and 2 photons that are most likely from a pi zero. And this is shown here. So on the right-hand side, you see again a 1D summary of the cuts we did before. This is now just the the invariant mass of all particles, right? The one I showed before. So the black curve is if we don't do anything. The blue curve is if we request a pi zero, and the it's green, I guess. The green curve is when you enforce energy momentum conservation. Fine. The question is now, okay, yeah, we have this spiky thing at the eta mass, but where is the eta? Where are my eta events, right? You know what I mean? Because, as I said, we successfully selected pi plus, pi minus, and pi zero. We did. But the problem is we have a competing reaction which does the direct pion production, right? So everything in the sample is coming from eta decaying to 3 pions, correct? But we also have a large amount of plus or minus pi zero that has been directly produced without any eta. So just to let you know, even though things look promising here, you still have to remember what is actually in your data. You should know the cross section of the reactions, and you should kind of try to understand why this shape is like it is, right? Again, in an ideal world, if you would not have this direct pion production decay, we would just see a nice Gaussian distribution like the one I showed before, a few slides, right? So the eta is somehow buried in here. Again, as I said before, some people might have performed the analysis different, but it's totally it's up to you. What I also wanted to quickly say is the selection criteria I've shown are not the ultimate truth. And I know I'm repeating myself, but I cannot stress this because people always ask me, why do you do this and that? Yeah, well, some things have to be done with reason, but some things are really a matter of taste. But what I can highly advise to you in any case is that you should, when you do your analysis or you're supposed to find a certain reaction, explore different analysis tools and techniques and compare them. Not because of the sake of analyzing or so, or using fancy algorithms, but to understand your data, right? For instance, what happens with my data if I use certain set of cuts and then I use a completely different set of cuts, and which events survive, which don't survive, and this gives you really a great understanding of your data set. And this is really important if you want to publish something. Also, data analysis, especially physics data analysis, is an iterative process, really. It's never done. Even when you think it's done, it's never done, never. You come up with a result and then your supervisor says, oh, this looks stupid, do something else. Or you get a result and then you don't understand the resolution or the number of events or whatever, or you, or in my case, right, you said, hey, this pi zero cut is a bit wide, make it tighter. Yeah, sure, I could do repeat analysis, make it tighter, and then actually compare the outcome. So again, there's not one way to do it, to analyze data, and it's never done. In any case, no matter which way you analyze the data or which cuts you want to use or whatever you prefer, which fancy method, two basic requirements have to be fulfilled. First is you have to consider your detector resolution. What I basically mean is, let's say you have a certain distribution of a certain variable you want to cut on. If the resolution is 100 MeV, then you have no sensitivity of a 1 kV cut. This just doesn't make sense, right? So you have to include the resolution of the detector. And then, of course, you have to consider reaction kinematics, right? Meaning that, as I said many times, energy momentum conservation. Look at this. Look at missing masses, look at missing energies or invariant masses or whatever you're interested in, and see how this affects your signal. And this actually leads me to what I initially wanted to talk about, and this is the kinematic fitting, because this is a very, how should I say, very nice way of taking care of these two points, as we will see. Are there any very urgent questions so far? Because now we will kind of switch gears. All the stuff I've shown so far, I show them because I want to give you a feeling on what goes into data analysis. It's important for the kinematic fit we will use. So, yeah, are there any urgent questions?
Sure, I'll
have a quick. Go ahead, Gabe.
Oh, okay, thanks. So, essentially, what you've shown is what would be in the case of GlueX, like what are called the measured variables, right?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Go ahead,
Jesse. I was going to ask something about, so you're applying all these cuts and your statistics are going down like really fast. So how does that play into your analysis?
Yeah, exactly. That's something you have to always keep track of, the statistics. Of course, most of the stuff you throw out is mostly direct pi plus pi minus production. But of course, you're right. You want to know how much of my signal am I actually throwing away, right? I mean, based on these plots, you cannot tell, okay, do I throw away 10% of my eta events, 5% or 90%? And there comes in the second part, which I have totally not talked about today. It's simulations, right? So what you would usually do is, so these are now all measured data, and you would now perform the same analysis on simulated data, right, that has been passed through a giant simulation, and you would basically check the simulated distribution simulations for each reaction independently. Do you know what I mean? So you would look at this distribution for simulated direct pi plus pi minus, apply the cuts I showed before, see how many events survive, calculate an efficiency, let's say 90% or 10%, I don't know. Then you do the same with the eta. I count the simulated events before and after applying your cuts, right? Calculate efficiency. And then you get a feeling on how much your cut actually throws away. And maybe you might want to tune it with respect to signal efficiency or background rejection. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, yeah. Thanks for asking. This is a really good question. You always should, and this is also another advice I forgot to put here, always have a good analysis, a good simulation set next to it, or a clean data set to analyze aside, just to get a feeling on how much you throw away. All right, kinematic fitting, yeah. It will now get a bit ugly. Sorry, but we have to do some math. Sorry for that. But I will try to go step by step. So again, let's start by off zero and say we have a reaction with n particles. Some incoming particles, like proton and proton target, and outgoing particles. Fine. We also assume that each particle is defined by a four vector, and we also assume that all particles, all the angles and moment of all particles are known. Okay, so we don't have the case where a particle is lost. This also exists, and you can also treat it with the kinematic fit. But for now, we just assume everything is known, everything is measured, and yeah. As I said, each vector, each momentum is defined by your detector, right? Angles, momenta. And also the detector is unfortunately not perfect, right? As I said before, we have, for instance, in our analysis case, we have an inefficiency, right? Left-hand side of the detector is a bit more efficient than right-hand side, but the momentum resolution is for negative particles is worse than for positive ones. So this folds in. So if you now, again, and I said before in the beginning, we have spherical coordinates, right? So each momentum we have, each angle has uncertainty. And this is basically shown here, right? So sigma p is the momentum uncertainty, sigma theta and sigma phi are the uncertainties for the two angles we have. But this also means, knowing that our detector is not perfect and that it folds in a certain resolution to each variable, this means that there must exist, what should I say, a true vector for each particle. Yeah, I didn't know how to put it properly in English, but there's like a, well, let's say original vector, right? The vector the particle has by nature before entering the detector. Because the outcoming vector particle vector we see is a reconstructed one where all the resolution effects are folded in, right? So anyway, so each particle should have an original, true original vector with a true momentum, true theta and the true phi, and we want to find this. If you now assume, and this is a a big assumption actually, if you now assume that everything is like Gaussian, so meaning that our measurements of the momentum of the angles are like Gaussian with the uncertainty sigma, right? We can formulate these quantities. So basically our measured momentum, for instance, is the original momentum, which we don't know yet, plus minus the uncertainty from our detector. Right? And we want to find this value. And similarly, you can look for the true theta and the true phi. And so we have the measured momenta, and we know the error of our measurements. So how do we find the true values exactly? By fitting. By fitting, that's all. That's the whole secret of it. That's kinematic fitting. You use your measurements and you use uncertainties and then you fit the thing. The question is, of course, how do we fit now? And I come to this in a second. These squares. So again, assuming that all the measured variables are Gaussian distributed, right, around the true value, right? You have a true value, you have the measurement uncertainty, and you assume that your measured variables are varying within this sigma range, right? And also assuming that all variables are uncorrelated. What this means, I will explain either today or next lecture, but this just means that all angle and momenta are measured independently, which is not, which is already a dangerous assumption, right? Anyways, assuming Gaussian uncertainties and independently measured variables, you can formulate a chi-square, right? So this is your measured momentum, you measured theta, and you measured phi for, let's say, particle E, which is either a proton, a pion, or a photon. And you divide it by sigma, right? I mean, you know chi-square from fitting. Yeah, and then you already formulate a chi-square, which is fine. So what you do is you minimize this whole expression and try to find these parameters, right? Fitted momentum, fitted theta, and fitted phi. But there's a caveat, because if you look at this equation, you can just say, yeah, okay, then I just plug in I set my measured value to my fitted value, and then I see chi squared to zero. So I didn't gain anything, right? You see this, right? If you put in, for instance, the measured p value here, then this thing is already zero, right? So this doesn't help much. You need additional information, and as I said before, it's the energy momentum conservation, because the true particle vectors, they come from a certain reaction. So all the particle momenta are kind of correlated to each other by energy momentum conservation. And this is what we need to constrain the fitted values so that you don't do this random, that you don't randomly take the original value again. Okay. So for this fitted momenta and fitted theta and phi angles, we request not only this guy to be minimal, but we also request that the sum of all particle momenta is zero. Yeah, so you have the the momentum of the incoming proton beam, the momentum of the target minus the momentum of the first proton, second proton, pi plus, pi minus, and so on. And you require that these, if you sum all these momenta up, you require that everything balances out to zero. Right? And similarly, you do the same for the energy, right? The energy of your particles. And that's already it. So what you can do is you formulate a set of constraint functions. I'm sorry for the math here, but it's just the same as the equations I've shown before, but just deconvoluted. So we have a set of constraint functions. First one is that we request that all momenta in x direction are balanced out. Right? So again, you have the x component of the four momentum of the beam, of the target, the first outgoing proton, and so on. Then you do the same for the y component of the four momentum vector, right? And then you do the same for the z component. Yeah. So you basically say that all, if I take all particles, I've measured my final state, you say then that all missing momenta in x, y, and z direction, they're all zero, right? So that they all belong from the one, from the same reaction. And finally, you have the energy constraint, right? So that all energies from all incoming and outgoing particles balance out as well, right? Do we have any questions so far, or is that clear? Okay, cool. All right. So if you now remember from the first slide, previous slide, we had this Nowak chi-square, right? Measured minus fitted, the one we hope to find, divided by the error or uncertainty in our experiment. Now plus this set of equations. Yeah. So we have, remember, so this expression is just the sum over all fitted particle momenta angles and so on, divided by the resolution squared. Oh, this is quite missing. I'm sorry for that. And now plus these four equations. Yeah. So you have to imagine this now, the sum over fx, fy, fz, and so on. These guys here are called the Lagrangian multipliers. Because if maybe you remember from math or calculus in school, you want to minimize a certain function which depends on, I don't know, n variables. But you don't want the fit values to take any arbitrary value, so you put in constraints. So you solve, you minimize a function with constraints. And this is, yeah, the Lagrange multiplier rule or whatever, I forgot the name. But yeah, this is where this thing guy comes from. It's minimization with constraints. So again, each V here corresponds to momentum theta phi, sigma the uncertainties, and the index I corresponds to your particle. All right, so, and now we are actually done, right? Because if we kind of minimize this guy, so we try V fit for each particle, so the fitted momentum, fitted theta, fitted phi, and also mimic, manage to get the constraints, fulfill the constraints, so meaning that all the missing momenta and energies are zero, and we are done. So we just need to minimize this beast. Yeah, I said just. It's not just the just, but you know what I mean. So when you go through literature or listen to talks or tutorials or notes, you see a different notation. So if you set the difference between the measured and fitted quantities, the ones you want to find, if you set it to epsilon, yeah, just call it epsilon, and then you can rewrite the whole expression into matrix notation, which looks more complicated, but it's more handy. So when you talk to someone who is an expert in kinematic fitting, you show him this, then he's immediately like, oh yeah, okay, I know what you're talking about. So just to let you know, so you have so the epsilons are measured values minus fitted ones, just as a vector. Then you have the Lagrange factors, which is again a vector, and the constraints are also expressed in the vector, right? So you have Lagrange vector times constraint vector, and this is actually the sum I showed before, right? This is just a sum expressed as a vector product, scalar vector product. So nothing too complicated. Now, this guy here, this guy is very important. This is the key element of the kinematic fit. This guy is called this V is the covariance matrix, or in this case, the inverse covariance matrix. If you compare this equation to the previous one, you conclude that this V summarizes all these uncertainties from the experiment. So all your errors, all the errors you measure on momenta, phi, and whatnot, all this goes into this matrix. And sometimes it's called error matrix. Depends on to whom you talk and depending on the slang. So that's a little funny thing. In CLUX, they call it the covariance matrix, which makes sense. But in my former experiment, everyone just said error matrix. So yeah, both names are fine. So again, the goal is still to minimize this equation. And what we put in experimentalists are, of course, the measured values, but also the uncertainties in our experiment. And this can be sometimes very tricky and have a high impact on the performance of the fitter. I guess we won't see it today, but next week.
Can I have a quick question?
Sure.
So these lambdas, the constraints, how are those obtained?
This is a fantastic question. Technically, they're fit. They're also fit parameters, but you don't let them free. That's stupid because then you have an overestimated system and this will not converge. You can actually calculate them by making, by approximating this thing in Taylor series. If you're really interested in this, I can make a quick slide on how to actually calculate them. It's not that difficult. I'm anyhow planning to have as a backup. So is it fine if we talk about this on Wednesday? Is that okay?
Yeah, that's perfectly fine. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, the lambdas are calculated by making few assumptions, which I will show next week. Again, this equation is valid only assuming that our measured quantities vary within a certain sigma Gaussian wise around the true value, and everything is measured independently. Otherwise, we run into trouble, as we will see in a few slides. So in a nutshell. I hope this wasn't too complicated and too much math. I always find it a headache to go through this, but this is the equation. This is what we want to minimize. We put in here the measured quantities, the vectors of all particles, and here the errors. And we have two components that go in a kinematic fit, just two. First one is that guy. This thing, all it does is improve the resolution. Yeah. So you have, for instance, the momentum vector of particle 3, which is, I don't know, let's say it's a pion. And within the sigma you provide, the error you provide will try to estimate an improved vector or different vector. But you also take into account that this particle has been produced in a reaction. So you have to include other particles that participate in this reaction. So this is this guy. Yeah. So this guy takes care that momentum and energy conservation are fulfilled and that the reaction hypothesis is met by the event you're looking at. To summarize things even more, kinematic fit does two things for you. First, it gives you fitted particle momenta, right? So it takes a detector resolution into account. Second, it allows you to reject all events that do not fulfill energy momentum conservation with respect to the reaction you're interested in. And if you remember a few slides earlier when I said no matter what analysis method you're using, you should include detector resolution and energy momentum conservation, kinematic fit does exactly that. So that's good. You're nearly there. Now, let me talk a bit on constraints and covariance metrics. As I said before, in this case, we talked about constraining the energy momentum, right? So you want that all momenta and all energies cancel out to zero. But you can also include, for instance, vertex, meaning that all particles come from the position where beam and target hit. In our case, we don't need this because, as I said, the side detector does not provide vertex information. Okay. You can have mass constraints between particles, right? Remember, we have two photons. They are supposed to come from a pi zero. Technically, we would say, yeah, we want energy momentum conservation, but we also want that the two photons add up to a pi zero. We will also talk about this on Wednesday. And then you can also say, okay, what happens if I have a reaction and unfortunate reaction? And unfortunately, I don't have one particle is not measured. Right? You can also kinematically fit this reaction by telling the fitter, oh, actually this particle with this mass is missing. I will not discuss this here because this is kind of, it's not difficult, but I simply will not talk about it here. I'm sorry for that. All right. Now, the most important thing, as I said before, is the covariance matrix. If you know the uncertainty for each particle, the covariance matrix has this form, right? So on the diagonals, you have the uncertainties for each particle in each component. So for instance, in this case, for instance, sigma 1 squared might be the uncertainty of the momentum of the first outcoming proton. Sigma 2 squared is the theta uncertainty of the first outcoming proton, and so on, right? Because we have, this index is wrong, I'm sorry for that. We have 3 times n errors, not n, I'm sorry for this mistake. Right, we have n particles, and each particle has 3 components, so this matrix is a 3n matrix. I missed the 3, this is annoying. Anyways, the rows you see here are the correlation factors between the variables and are symmetric. What are correlations? I will talk about it in 1 minute or so, or so. Yeah, so these are the correlations between your measurements. All you have to know about here is that this matrix is symmetric. This is a good thing. Symmetric matrices are, in most cases, your friends.
In the last slide, didn't you assume that nothing's really correlated?
Correct. Very good. Very good. Very good. Exactly. So following what I said on the previous slide, all these guys should be zero. But for completeness, I showed the real covariance matrix, right?
Okay.
But you're right. again, in order for the kinematic fit to work, it is really important that you know how this guy looks like. And it is really to know, actually, do I have non-diagonal, do I have off-diagonal elements or not? So you have to really to know this guy. One thing about what are correlations, a simple example. So let's say you want to measure the momentum for a certain particle. Right? And let's say you have a subdetector, this blue box. And the particle is coming in with initial momentum, p, under a certain angle. And let's say the subdetector gives you a uniform resolution over all angles. Now this detector is brilliant, and it gives you the momentum very precisely, independent of theta, right? Because no matter where the particle enters the detector, you will always get the same answer, right? So in this case, the correlation between momentum and theta is zero, right? Because no matter where the particle inside this detector enters, the angle doesn't matter. So your reconstruct momentum only depends on the initial momentum. Okay. Now, this is again, this is a very idealistic situation. Now, let's go to a more realistic setup. Now we have a detector that is segmented, right? For instance, imagine you have different bars. Now, you could be, you have different scintillators or whatnot. Now, we have a theta information because, as you imagine, these bars are separated, so you have efficiency gaps. So the momentum resolution is quite bad here, or here, or here. And now if you assume further that each bar has different energy resolution, then already you have a theta-dependent momentum reconstruction. This is shown here. So in this case, you would have to set rho not equal to zero. And again, I cannot stress it enough. Knowing your detector means you have to knowing the correlation, the covariance matrix. Yeah. So we have now 2:10. Are there any questions so far? Before I go on, are there any important questions or things you don't understand or want me to clarify on something? Okay. Okay, then I will just go on for the next 5 minutes. All right. Again, so now let's assume we have our set of variables, we have our errors, everything's uncorrelated, everything is fine. And then we minimize the equation I showed before, right? We minimize the equation, we find the fitted values. Then we get a distribution for the chi-square, right? Because the fit won't always return zero, right? I mean, sometimes I have particles with a good resolution, so I have a chi-square to zero. Sometimes I have particles with a very bad resolution, so the chi-square is not at zero, but somewhere else. And this is the distribution you expect here, right? So the chi-square, this is a chi-square distribution in case of uncorrelated Gaussian distributed variables, right? And in order to compute this thing, this distribution, you need the number of degrees of freedom. I will talk about this next week, but this basically just, as you know from fitting, the number of degrees of freedom is basically the number of constraints minus the number of unknowns, right? And here you see the distribution for different number of degrees of freedoms. And the first thing is to do, let's say you perform a kinematic fit. The first thing you would do is you would plot the chi-square distribution. How does it look like? And would compare it to the ideal curve. Let's say you have a fit with just where all particles are measured and all particles, and you request energy momentum conservation. This would be a fit with 4 degrees of freedom. So this would correspond to the black curve. So you would basically compare this ideal curve to your curve, the ones you observe from your data, and try to figure out why is it different, right? Again, why could any deviation from one of these curves is either, for instance, you have a lot of background events that do not match the hypothesis you're looking at, or you did not set your correlation matrix properly. Maybe your errors are too small or too large, or maybe you violated one of the assumptions we made, right? The variables are not measured independently. They are correlated, highly correlated, right? So, but you might now say, this is a bit complicated. So I do a kinematic fit, I get a chi-square distribution, and every time I have to compare it to one of these ideal things, it's kind of annoying. But there's also a better way to do it, because you can kind of translate this chi-square into a probability, which is shown here. So this is a probability function, which kind of, the interpretation of this thing is kind of tricky. So this is the kinematic fit probability based on the chi-square you obtain. And it's basically a probability of how should I say, that the observed chi-square from your model is wrong compared to the true chi-square. Yeah, I know this explanation is a bit, it's not good. But that's basically the meaning of this probability. In any case, for Gaussian errors and uncorrelated measurements, you observe a flat curve, right? Because if you just take this chi-square and do this calculation, and you have no bias in, yeah, and you don't have any... weird shapes, and you get this flat distribution, right? Because this is, if you compare it to the chi-square distribution formula before, this is exactly the same. You just normalize it, okay? So just think of the chi-square distribution normalized, basically. It's not a good explanation, but this kind of explains why it's flat. So, and this is actually nice, because you have your measurement, you do your kinematic fit, and you compare whatever shape you have in your probability, you compare it to a flat curve. And any deviation, you then can then say, oh, wait, I have a deviation in this and that probability range. This is related to I don't know what. I think I will stop here now. And because it's quarter past 2. Right, and I was told the lecture is 60 plus 15 minutes. So I think I will stop here and then continue on Wednesday, because there are several slides now coming, and I'd rather start fresh next on Wednesday. Continue. Everyone is fine with that.
Sure. Sure. I have one question before we go.
Sure.
On slide 22,
yeah,
and you have the plot of the correlation. So, how are the correlations calculated? Is that, I mean, is that straightforward? Or, I mean, it doesn't seem so, but.
Yeah. Again, that's a very good question. They're correlated by knowing your experiment. For instance, let's say what you could plot the resolution of each element as a function of theta, right? And then you would see whatever distribution, either a flat one, or you would say, I don't know, a wave or whatever, I don't know. And this is basically, from this shape, you could then kind of determine the correlation. Or what you could do is you could calculate, you could just have a data with all your momenta and theta and calculate, for instance, the Pearson correlation coefficient. It's a very simple thing. I didn't put a slide for that here, but this is also what you can do. Or take any other correlation coefficient formula you have. This is something you can do.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right. Any other questions so far? All right, seems not to be the case. Then we will see on Wednesday at the same time, right?
Yes. Oh, are you going to post mm-hmm. these slides as well?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I will post the slides, the homework, and everything, and in the link I provided earlier. So yeah, I will do that. Yeah, okay. It should be up tomorrow morning, the latest. Kind of. Okay.
Thank you, Daniel.
Great. All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.